Welcome to the U.S. Global Investors Webcast, Global Investing Outlook, a webcast with Dr. Mark Faber and Frank Holmes. Please note that the slides you see on your screen are controlled by the presenters. Also, you may print a copy of today's slides at any time by clicking on the Print Slides button on your screen. A question and answer session will follow today's presentation. If you would like to submit a question during the webcast, simply enter your question in the dialog box at the bottom of the presentation screen and press enter. Now, we would like to begin by introducing Michael Dunn, Director of our Institutional Services of U.S. Global Investors.
Thank you. U.S. Global Investors is very pleased to make time for us in your busy schedules today. Without delay, I'm going to get right to our speakers. Folks that are familiar with U.S. Global, or precious metals and resources investing for that matter, know Frank Holmes. Frank is the CEO and CIO of U.S. Global Investors, which he bought in 1989. Frank is an intrepid traveler and is leaving tonight for 2 weeks in Asia. He believes strongly in the tacit knowledge that one gets from on-the-ground research. If you haven't already, check out Frank's first book, The Gold Watcher, Demystifying Gold Investing. Please welcome Frank Holmes. Frank?
Thank you, Michael. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Pleased to bring one of the market's most interesting commentators, Dr. Mark Faber, who I've known for many years. In fact, we first met with Ian McAvity, another great market technician and a true historian of financial markets. For years, Mark was considered a contrarian. He was a China bull when much of the rest of the market was only interested in technology. And as a Barron's Roundtable member in February 2008, he offered another prescient forecast warning about the risks of currency debasement and a leverage bubble. Dr. Faber was born in Zurich, studied economics at the University of Zurich. At the age of 24, he obtained his PhD in economics, magna cum laude. Please check out Dr. Faber's web, gloomboomdoom.com. I'll repeat that, gloomboomdoom.com. or markfaberblog.blogspot.com. Now, Dr. Faber.
Well, thank you very much, Frank, for this very kind introduction, and thank you for the listeners that I can share some of my views with them. Paul Krugman, who won a Nobel Prize in economics, says that the world should have another bubble here, that it would help out, even if we had later on to pay for it. I'm not sure that this is correct, because if the policy that was suggested by him, and by the way by others, following the high-tech boom in the late 1990s. So if you turn to page 5, you can see what happened at the time. Basically, we had a capital spending boom concentrated in telecommunication, media, and technology. And we had a colossal NASDAQ bubble, which was fueled largely following the bailout of LTCM in 1998, because easy monetary policies were applied, and because the bailout of LTCM by the government, basically by the Fed and the Treasury, gave Wall Street confidence that there would always be a Greenspan put. And so the NASDAQ went up by 48% between 1997 and March 2000. It doubled, actually, between August 1999 and March 2000 and became grossly overvalued. And then inevitably the bust came after March 2000, and it looked as if the U.S. would enter a recession, which it experienced for a couple of months. But then the Fed reacted very aggressively. You can see on slide 5 that after January 2001, it cut the Fed fund rate from 6.5% to 1%, 1.75% by year-end, and then down to 1% in 2003. And it left the Fed fund rate at 1% until June 2004. But actually, the economy began to recover already in November 2001. So we had artificially low interest rates, And after June 2004, the Fed then increased interest rates, but we never had really any monetary tightening, and I shall explain in a minute why not. And then you can see that the Fed fund rate went up to 5.25% in August 2006, and it stood there until September 18, 2007, when the problems in the subprime area were perceived to have spread to the banking sector. The Fed didn't notice that soon enough, and then they started to slash interest rates to, at the present time, essentially zero. But I'd like to point out that this monetary policy that is being pursued by the Federal Reserve, which is aiming at boosting asset prices, actually leads to more economic and financial volatility. As an example, on page 6, you can see the CRB index. It's a broad index of various commodities. It had peaked out in 1980 and had been in a bear market until 1998-1999, when it bottomed out at 182. They made the second low in 2001 at 185. And then we had a very strong bull market in commodities until May 2006, when commodity prices then peaked out for the first time. And after May 2006, they traded sideways. But when the rate cuts came in September 2007, commodities went ballistic. And you can see that the CRB, which had peaked out at 365 in May 2006 and then traded in a range between 280 and 320, it went up to 473 in July 2008, that was about a year ago. And since then, it collapsed down to less than 200 by year-end 2008, and now it's rebounded strongly, driven mostly by industrial commodity prices. But all I want to say is, had the Fed not cut so aggressively rates after September 2007, the CRB would never have gone ballistically up to this high level of 473. So basically, the monetary policies that are being pursued in the U.S. lead to a lot of volatility in all asset markets and in economic activity. I'd also like to mention that the easy monetary policies of the Fed also lead to colossal debt growth. And you can see on page 7 of my presentation how credit in the U.S. as a percent of GDP has moved in the last roughly 100 years. There was a rapid rise of debt in the 1920s, and debt peaked out in 1929 at 186% of GDP, and then they soared in the 30s because GDP went down sharply, so the debt to GDP expanded. And then afterwards we had a period of deleveraging, and debt as a percent of GDP then held relatively steady around 140% of GDP. That was still the case in 1980, and now they're 375% of GDP and rising still rapidly. Now, I'm addressing this debt issue because there was recently an article by Mr. Krugman in the New York Times entitled, "How Did Economists Get It So Wrong?" Well, first of all, I think the title should have been, "How Did I Get It So Wrong?" and not, "How Did Economists Get It So Wrong?" And I'd also like to point out, it's not every economist that got it so wrong. The economists at the Federal Reserve and the economists at Treasury and the economists at universities got it so wrong. But private economists have been warning about this excessive debt growth for quite some time, and we're very concerned about it. But the interesting part of the article of Mr. Krugman, which runs 6,000 words, in other words, it's a very extensive article, is that it never even mentions the Austrian School of Economics, and it just mentions one economist that is from the school, but en passant, and in a rather derogatory way, Joseph Schumpeter, and the whole article never addresses for one word the issue of excessive debt, of credit growth, of excessive leverage at all. Never is that mentioned in any of the explanations of how the crisis came about. And I also like to point out, in his speeches and in his writings, Mr. Bernanke also never mentioned the excessive debt as a problem and as having been the destabilizing factor, both for the depression in the 30s and the current crisis at the present time. Finally, I'd like to mention that with debt to GDP at this level and the unfunded liabilities arising from Medicare and Medicaid, which are now at around $59 trillion, in my opinion, tight monetary policies in the U.S., as far as the eye can see, are out of the question. The government in the U.S. will continue to print money with all the negative consequences that go along with it. The other thing that I think is important to understand, see page 8, is that this whole debt build-up occurs during a period of declining interest rates. On page 8, I'd like to also point out that interest rates move in very long-term cycles. In other words, the interest rates bottomed out at less than 2% on the 10-year treasury in the 1940s. By 49, we were still at 2%, in 1960 at 4%, in 1970 at 6%, and then we went up to a peak of over 15% in 1981. And since then, interest rates have been in a declining trend. And in my opinion, we bottomed out in long-term interest rates in the U.S. on December 18, 2008, when the 10-year Treasury note went down to 2.08% and the 30 years to 2.53%. And from here onwards, we will rather have a rising interest rate structure in the United States and also around the world. It will be irregular, but the tendency, in my opinion, given the huge debt build-up by the government, will be for interest rates to go up in future. Now, on the following page 9, you can see essentially what happened. And I have to stress here that even under a gold standard where money and credit is relatively tightly controlled, you can get bubbles in one sector of the economy or in another. But Mr. Bernanke and Mr. Greenspan, what they managed to do is really create a bubble in everything. And you can see on page 9 an index of various asset prices, the S&P, the CRB, real estate, and the dollar inverted, had a huge rally between 2002 and 2008. Everything went up. Arts prices, real estate prices, commodities, and it's not just in the U.S., everywhere in the world. The only asset that during this period of time went down was the U.S. dollar. Now comes 2008, everything goes down, but the dollar rallies. And then you can see that the markets bottomed out, essentially irregularly, some markets bottomed out actually already in October to December of last year. Say the S&P then bottomed out on March 6th at 666, March 6th of this year. And then asset markets rallied again, but the dollar became weak again. So in other words, we have a relationship where asset prices go up when the dollar is weak, and they go down when the dollar strengthens, and the relationship is due to the fact that when the dollar is strong, it is a symptom that global liquidity tightens and that reduces the supply of dollars, and so the dollar strengthens. On the other hand, when the dollar is weak, it means there's excessive liquidity in the system, and so the dollar weakens, but it's good for asset prices. And so I think that looking forward, investors have to be very clear that if the dollar is very weak, there is a chance that equity prices around the world continue to rally and could actually rally quite substantially, as we shall see later on. On the other hand, if the dollar should strengthen, which I doubt given the Fed's policy of keeping interest rates at zero and stimulating and trying to stimulate consumption, it is unlikely that the dollar will be a very strong currency except for brief periods of time. Now, after 2008, we had a colossal collapse in wealth, and what has not been explained sufficiently is that compared to previous recessions post-Second World War, this recession has really brought down home prices and real estate values very significantly. You can see on page 10 that in the 73-74 recession, in the 82 recession, home prices actually continued to go up. In 1990, they dipped briefly, but for a very brief period of time, and mainly because of California. But this time, they got hit very hard. Now, the Federal Reserve said, well, the problem is that home prices went down. But I dispute it's not that home prices went down that is the problem. The problem is visible on the right-hand side of page 10. It's the lack of homeowners' equity, the excessive leverage that was utilized in homes. You can see that in the 50s, you still had homeowners' equity. That was in the 50s, if someone bought a home for $100,000, he would have equity of, say, $80,000. In other words, the borrowings were just $20,000. So homeowners' equity was 80%. In the 70s and the 80s, it was also still 70%. But this time around, partly encouraged by artificially low interest rates and partly encouraged verbally by the Federal Reserve that looked upon subprime lending as being favorable and also encouraged by institutions like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the homeowners' equity declined substantially and people borrowed more and more against their homes. That was really the problem of the housing market, not that home prices went down, the excessive leverage. Now, on the following page, you can see actually what happened economically very visibly, and that's why I also find the Federal Reserve essentially in a mistaken belief that the problems were not foreseeable. You can see on the left-hand side, total new borrowings by households and non-financial businesses. That is essentially the credit growth in the economy, ex-government. Now, if you look at 2004 to 2007, the period that coincided with the interest rate increases by the Fed from 1% to 5.25%, you can actually see that credit growth accelerated. And that's meaningful because tight money means that you slow down your credit growth. But the Federal Reserve never paid any attention, and so credit growth accelerated from an annual rate of 7% in June 2004 to a peak rate of annualized growth of 18% at the end of 2006. Then credit growth began to slow down, but following the rate cuts in September 2007, it accelerated again, once again, a little bit. And then in 2008, it totally collapsed. And of course, for an economy that is driven by credit, such as the U.S., a total credit growth collapse is a disaster. Now, the Federal Reserve knows that, and the Treasury as well. So what they're doing on page 12 is the private sector, household and business, as a percent of the economy is deleveraging. You know, the households and businesses are behaving rational, you know, because they're saving more, that they're paying down their debts. That's a rational action to take in a recession such as we have. And the government comes in and builds up through fiscal deficits its borrowings, and so the U.S. Treasury debt as a percent of the economy expands very rapidly. And the problem with all this is, in my opinion, the fiscal deficits, which this year probably will be around $2 trillion, in my opinion, they can't really come down significantly, because the moment you would reduce your fiscal deficit, you would again have a negative impact on the economy. So I think that as far as the eye can see, we will have artificially low interest rates, near zero, for a long time, because unemployment in the U.S. is not going to go away overnight. It will stay structurally high. And at the same time, the deficits will stay very high, and that will lead, in my opinion, sometimes down the road to more inflation, which will then necessitate more money printing in order to keep short-term rates artificially low. Now, concerning asset prices, and I always say to people that they have to detach themselves from a close association of the economy with asset markets. What you can get in the world is a weak economy and very strong asset markets, because if you have excess capacity, then nobody builds a new factory. Nobody will acquire new equipment for the production. But when the liquidity is being created by the Federal Reserve through quantitative easing and through large fiscal deficits, the liquidity then flows somewhere. And it flows first into cash balances. And you can see there that savings deposits as a percent of the Wilshire Index have risen very strongly. And once people have these deposits, if interest rates are zero, and if the view is that the Federal Reserve will keep interest rates for a very long time, when the recovery comes below the rate of inflation, then people take these deposits like they did after 2003, and they stuck it into some assets. It could be real estate, as was the case in 2003 to 2007, or it could be into stocks, or it could be in commodities. But they will stuck it in something. And so I would argue, actually, that the weaker the economy is, the more stimulus, fiscal stimulus will be applied, and the more money printing will take place under the Fed chairman, Mr. Bernanke, who is history's greatest money printer. So that is an important point to understand. There is plenty of liquidity around, and it will flow somewhere. And for us, it's obviously important to understand in what kind of assets will it flow mostly into. I shall return to this question in a minute. Now, the aim of the Federal Reserve is to make savings unattractive. In other words, make cash unattractive, to push it into assets. They hope that it will go into housing and boost home prices or stabilize home prices, which probably they will do. And they hope to essentially boost stock prices. But as you can see on page 14, it's not so evident that stocks are that low in terms of stock market capitalization as a percent of the economy. We are now at 80%, close to 100%, and that is still higher than at the peak level in 1929 and in 1966. So I don't think that stocks are all that inexpensive. But as I said, if you pursue a monetary policy aimed at driving down or keeping interest rates at zero and pushing people into assets, then you can have essentially a weak dollar, and at the same time, stocks can catch up and compensate for the weakness in the dollar by appreciating somewhat. Now, the consumer in the United States is an important point to consider. You can see the trade balance, which turned negative in the 1980s when the expansionary fiscal policies of Mr. Reagan occurred, but it held then relatively steady. And then after 1999, after the experiment with ultra-expansionary monetary policies, we had excessive consumption, and the trade deficit and the current account deficit widened very substantially. And then when the recession came and the consumer contracted, the trade deficit also contracted. In principle, everything else being equal, it should be good for the dollar. But as you know, there are other factors that have an impact on the dollar, such as monetary policies, which are now extremely expansionary, in my opinion. Now, the reason I'm mentioning this trade deficit, the explosion after 1999 into 2007, is that obviously the U.S. embarked on overconsumption, which was driven by excessive debt growth in the period 1999 to 2007. And this excessive consumption led then to imports that were met, and to put it very bluntly, from Asia principally, and China specifically. So after 2001, the exports from China to the United States went up very strongly. Industrial production in China picked up, and employment picked up, domestic consumption picked up, and as the exports continued to go up, capital spending picked up, and that all led to an increased demand from China for raw materials. And it drove up commodity prices meaningfully. Commodity prices have been in a secular bear market since 1980, and where in the commodity space little investments have taken place. And you can see how the oil went up from $10 in 1998 to a peak of $147 in 2008. And you can see that the outlays of the world for oil, total spending on oil, went from roughly $500 billion in 98 to, at the peak last year, over $4 trillion annually. And that led to tremendous prosperity in the resource-producing regions of the world. And so these resource producers, from the Middle East to Central Asia, Russia, the African producers, Australia, Latin America, began to purchase luxury goods and also capital goods from Europe and Japan. And then we had the synchronized boom that we experienced in the period 2005 to 2007. I have to say, probably in our lifetime, we will never again have this kind of synchronized boom. This is most unusual economically, that the whole world was in boom conditions. And in future, I would rather expect that some countries will do well and others will do less well. But one thing that is interesting to observe is that we're living in a period in history where enormous changes are occurring. For the last 200 years, it's the rich countries of the West that essentially became richer and richer, and the poor countries in emerging economies, first for 150 years in the form of being colonies, and thereafter in the form of essentially having regimes that were not particularly desirable. They were essentially impoverished, and also they were suffering for a long period of time after the breakdown of colonialism under communism and socialism and policies of isolation. But now these countries have been unleashed, and you can see for the history that motor vehicle sold in emerging economies now exceed vehicles sold in the advanced economies. Car sales in China are now also higher than in the United States. So I'm mentioning this because sometimes people, they think that emerging economies are poor, or sometimes they feel that the emerging economies depend very much on the Western world and the rich industrial countries and so forth. That is no longer the case. They are a very, very powerful economic bloc, and they will become a very, very powerful political bloc as well, and military bloc. And that is something that will create a lot of tensions in the world, and I'll talk about this in a second. The other point to remember is that in the past, usually the rich countries of the West financed poor countries' economic development. But this time around, if you look at slide number 18, you can see actually that the big reserves are in emerging economies. the foreign exchange reserves. These foreign exchange reserves were built up, especially after 1998, as a result of the U.S. current account deficit. In other words, the current account deficit in the U.S. went up from $150 billion in 1998 to annually $800 billion, and that flushed the world with liquidity, led to strong economic growth, but it also led to these asset bubbles I was referring to earlier. Now, some people have been concerned that Asia could have another crisis like they had after 1997. The conditions are very different. In 97, in the period preceding 97, we had in Asia, in most countries, current account deficits were dependent on foreign capital. This time around, the Asian region is actually very affluent. We have the capital. The Americans depend on us essentially buying their treasury securities or buying their agency securities. And so the situation is very different, and I think that the Asian region is going to weather the crisis relatively well, not perfectly well, but relatively well because of the excessive liquidity that exists in Asia. I'd also like to point out that in Asia we have currencies that, in my opinion, are still undervalued. Some of them have appreciated, like the Australian and New Zealand dollar, but currencies like the Chinese currency are still significantly undervalued. And you can see that between 1981 and 1994, the Chinese RMB depreciated by 80%, then it was pegged, and now it's gradually appreciating. And I think going forward, next 5 to 10 years, we could easily see a doubling in the value of the Chinese currency against the U.S. dollar. And that would then allow other currencies in Asia, like the Singapore dollar, the Malaysian ringgit, the Thai baht, to appreciate. Because the other currencies, they have difficulties to appreciate unless the Chinese currency also appreciates. Now, I'm mentioning all this strong economic development in Asia that has obviously slowed down, and in the manufacturing sector in Asia, we obviously have a recession because exports collapsed. But I'd like to emphasize that in Asia, we have low per capita consumption in raw materials still, and we have a lack of some resources. As you can see on slide 20, the Chinese have very little natural gas, they have little crude oil compared to their population, little uranium, very little iron ore and copper. And so they're not going to stop buying these commodities. They may buy in 1 year less, but it's not going to be a situation where they won't buy anything at all. You can actually see on page 21 how big China has become in terms of its manufacturing capacity. On the left-hand side of page 21, you have the share of global production of steel and of aluminum coming out of China. Chinese steel production went from 10% of the world in 1990 to now over 40%, and aluminum production from 10% of the world's production in year 2000 to now over 30%. That isn't going to go away because a lot of this production is actually not for exports, but actually for the domestic market, for domestic consumption. And on the following page 22, you can see that the per capita consumption of oil, and by the way, also other resources in China and in India, is still extremely low compared to, say, more advanced economies such as Japan, South Korea, and, of course, the energy-wasting United States. So, in sum, I would argue that actually oil demand in China and India, and we haven't even talked very much about India so far, but India is also a country with 1 billion people that in future can have a trendline growth, in my opinion, of, say, between 5% to 7% annually, the way China has probably a trendline growth of between, I don't know, 6% to 9% annually for the next 10, 20 years. So that should essentially support crude oil demand in these two countries. And you can see on page 23 that whereas in industrialized countries of the West, oil demand has been down in emerging economies, it slowed down, but it's still growing. So I feel that the demand for resources is actually well supported. And there's another factor that I think is important to understand. The bull market in commodities that began in essentially 2001 and lasted to 2008 and was followed by the collapse in 2008, this bull market in commodities was, in my opinion, too short to really trigger a supply response. Because once the market collapsed in 2008, a lot of projects were cancelled, or a lot of exploration companies didn't get the money to carry on with the exploration. And incidentally, you can see in the case of oil, the pattern of discovery of new oil reserves. The maximum oil reserves were discovered actually in the 1950s and 1960s, and since then, new oil reserves are being found, but in smaller and smaller quantities, and also at higher and higher costs, because they have to be found in areas that are inhospitable or very deep in the sea or on land. And so, in my opinion, when I look at the demand pattern of China and Indian rest range, and I look at the supply pattern, I think that oil prices will have a rising trend. I'm here leaving out the money printing function of Mr. Bernanke. The more money he prints, the more oil and other commodities will, of course, also go up, and that would include precious metals as well. Now, the other point that I think is important to understand in this whole discussion is the dynamics of the oil market with respect to the U.S. and of China in terms of geopolitics. The U.S. in the 70s, when the last oil crisis hit, was still over 70% self-sufficient in oil. In other words, they only imported about 25% of their oil requirements. But now they import over 75% of their oil requirements. And in the case of China, you can see the light blue line at the bottom is the reserves. They're falling. The horizontal line is the production. It's flat, and the demand is going up. And after 94, the demand exceeded the supply. In other words, they became the second largest oil user in the world and oil importer. And the U.S., they can essentially source oil from Mexico and Canada. They can source oil also from the Middle East, from West Africa, from Latin America, and so forth and so on. The Asians, they source all their oil, or 95% of it, and that applies to Japan, Taiwan, South Korea, and China, from the Middle East. And so basically the U.S. is in Iraq for the oil, and China is in Sudan also for the oil. And you can see on the following page 26, that the oil supplies to Asia are, of course, vulnerable in the sense that they all come on the sea lane and they pass through the Strait of Malacca, which could be interrupted, or they pass by the southern tip of Taiwan, which essentially strategically could block shipments to Japan or to China. So that will, in my opinion, lead to some tensions, and the tensions will arise probably in Central Asia. On the following page 27, you can see a map of Kazakhstan and also Afghanistan. The Americans have, of course, their bases in Central Asia. But that is not in the interest of the Chinese, because the Chinese, they need Central Asia, A, to source some oil that will pipeline to Kazakhstan, and B, for the access through Central Asia to the Middle East. And the Russians are also not pleased to have American bases in Central Asia, because it essentially encircles them. And the Indians are not supportive of an American victory against the Taliban, because the Taliban keeps essentially the Pakistani army busy on the Western Front. In other words, they are less likely to engage in confrontation with India as long as they're kept busy on the western border of Pakistan. In short, nobody has any interest that the Americans win in Afghanistan. They have not much of an interest that the Taliban win. But what they have an interest in is to bleed the United States and to keep the war going as long as possible. So essentially what this will do is it will escalate the war costs very dramatically. And we have now in Afghanistan already 62,000 American troops, and we have over 50,000 contractors, basically mercenaries, and that number will escalate, and it's very costly, and in my opinion, this will essentially be a very heavy drag on the fiscal deficit of the United States going forward, and it will be also in terms of human costs very high, because every country has some specialties. The Swiss know how to make chocolate and watches, and the Italians fashion goods. The business of the Afghanis is to fight. And they've been doing that for hundreds of years, and they're very good at it. And the geography of Afghanistan is very conducive to essentially a guerrilla war, and also the borders of Afghanistan are very porous, because that used to be the big Central Asian region where the nomads would come from Turkmenistan and from the north, from Kazakhstan, from Russia, and also from Pakistan. And so it's very difficult to fight actually a war in that region. Now, I'm mentioning all this because I think that over time we will have more tensions. We have China coming up. America wants to contain the rise of China. And we have China that will become more active geopolitically. And obviously, war is a possibility sometimes in future. And when war occurs, obviously commodity prices go up, with the result that usually the major commodity peaks occur during wartime, as you can see on page 28. The Napoleonic Wars, the American Civil War, World War One, and Vietnam all coincided essentially with commodity prices. So I think that investors should own commodities, obviously not derivatives with UBS and AIG and Citigroup, but physical commodities or mining companies that are well-run and well-financed. I think that despite the increase in commodity prices in real terms in page 29, we're still at the low level. Some people will say the price of gold is high. Well, I think the price of gold compared to the S&P is actually relatively low, and that in future we could have a further meaningful increase in precious metals for reasons that I shall explain again. On the following page 30, you can see that a government can pursue monetary policies that can stabilize the economy temporarily with fiscal measures and with monetary policies and zero interest rates. But if you look at the pattern of the recovery after 2001, it's been a very asymmetrical recovery that benefited essentially the well-to-do people and in particular the financial sector. And it occurred at the cost of the middle class and of the workers. And if you look at employment today, this has never happened since the Depression. Employment today is lower than it was in 1999, whereas the population in the U.S. has grown by 30 million. So we have essentially had a recovery post-2001 without much real, and by real I mean an improvement in the standards of living of the majority of people. That hasn't really occurred. And so you can print money and you can increase your debt and you can put everything on the balance sheet of the government, but it is unlikely to help a typical household in the United States. It may help Wall Street and it may help some asset markets, but not the standards of living. That should be clear. Otherwise, if money printing would make country's rich, Zimbabwe would be the richest country at the present time. Now, having said that, if I look at the stock market returns over the last, say, 100 years, it's unusual that in a 10-year period we have negative returns. And you can see on page 31 that we have actually negative returns. They're some of the worst returns ever. I think following 10 years we'll have probably positive returns in U.S. stocks. The big question is obviously what will happen to the currency. But I think that you will be better off by being invested in stocks than in bonds and in cash. Now, the position is such today that we are applying the same policies that led us into trouble post-2001, in other words, easy monetary policies, and we're trying to create other bubbles. We still have excessive trading volumes, see page 32. And we still have essentially a Dow Jones that inflation adjusted is relatively high. We're nowhere near really low that were established in the 1930s or the 1982. I think that stocks will have moderate gains, and as I mentioned before, it will also depend on the position of the U.S. dollar. And let me explain you what I mean by that. On slide 34, I have a table that shows the movement of Mexican stocks between 1979 and 1988. And the movement is in the top column, table 1, in local currency. And in table 2, it's in U.S. dollars. And in table 3, you have the performance of the Mexican fund that was launched in 1980 at $10 per unit. Now, you can see at the top that in local currency, the market went up from a low in 79 of roughly 1,000 to a peak. It's not very well visible on your chart, but the peak in 87 was 343,000. And in dollar terms, during the same period of time, we went from a low of 48 to a peak of 220. So in local currency, the market went up much more than in dollar terms. And you can actually see that in 88, the dollar low was about 62, which was below the peak in 1979, which was at 70. So in dollar terms, the market over this 10-year period moved more or less flat, but in local currency, even after the crash in 87, we were up from roughly 1,000 to 178,000. Now, the Mexican fund perform miserably like most funds do, except ones run by global investors. But you can see that essentially the following happened. In local currency, the market went up because of money printing, but on page 35, it's visible how the Mexican peso collapsed. So in local currency, the market goes up, but the currency collapses, and in dollar terms, the market hardly moves. And this, I think, could happen in the United States, that the market continues to go up, but that the dollar collapses. Then the question comes up against what? Will the dollar collapse? My view, it's not so evident that it will totally implode against the euro and other paper currencies, because the other central bankers are also money printers. But in my opinion, it will continue to implode against commodities, some more than others, but commodities where the shortages are there will perform okay. And in particular, when interest rates are at zero, then obviously gold, silver, platinum, palladium become currencies of choice, because I don't see why someone would hold dollars and not own some physical gold. There is no cost associated with holding the gold compared to dollars. That has no return for you. So I think that gradually more and more people will come to the realization that they have to own some resources, some commodities, and some mining companies, and obviously some physical precious metals. So my investment themes are essentially farmland. The Japanese market was at the low in March, at the same level it was in 1981. So I can say that we've probably completed a secular bear market from where we can now have a long-term increase in prices. Gold and silver are long. Treasury bonds in the U.S. of course short. You don't want to invest in a bonds market that is manipulated by a money printer and where the fiscal deficits will continue to be very, very high and probably actually increase. And I think that monetary policies will remain expansionary, which probably will mean that the stock market in the U.S., when it bottomed out at 666 in March, that this was a major low, because the moment the market would decline once again, say below 800 on the S&P, or even below 900 on the S&P, everybody will say we need more stimulus and more easing of the monetary policy, so you will have more money printing and more fiscal deficit, and that will obviously be negative for the dollar, but it will be good for equity prices. So I think that your downside risk in equities is relatively limited. But as I pointed out, you can only assume that the U.S. market will go up meaningfully in nominal terms, not in real terms. Thank you for your attention.
Well, thank you, Mark. Michael, do you have any questions from the audience?
Yeah, there's a number of questions that have queued up, and just as a reminder, on your screen, you should see the Q&A button. If you have any questions, please do enter your questions and send them on over to us. First question, Dr. Faber, you've mentioned a couple of investment vehicles and strategies for the current market environment.
Sorry, I can't hear the question.
Do you have any input on currencies that you're particularly bullish on at the present time?
Well, I mean, I have to say the sentiment on the dollar is very negative, and I mean, we could have a kind of a low in dollar terms. In terms of dollar anytime soon. And the rebound, because we're very oversold, sentiment is extremely bearish and so forth. And I have to say, I mean, I think that gold is a desirable asset, but for my taste, there was a little bit too much euphoria just recently when gold went over $1,000. And so what we could get is kind of a correction in gold, and then a little bit of rebound in dollars. That is a possibility. But in general, I think that if you want the currency, the Singapore dollar is a desirable currency, and let me explain you why. The Singapore economy is very well balanced. It's everything considered, education level, security, government, quality of the government, which it's really nowadays a disaster in the United States. I'm sorry to say that, but that's the case. It's the richest country, and with the taxes on the rich going up everywhere in Europe and in the UK and in the United States, a lot of people will move away. They'll move to Singapore and Hong Kong and Asian cities where essentially the tax regimes are very friendly to foreigners. And so I think that the Singapore dollar is a desirable currency. And you can buy in Singapore stocks. They will fluctuate, but I think they're reasonably priced. You can find a lot of very good companies with dividend yield of 5 to 6%.
Thank you, Dr. Faber. Frank, question regarding resources stocks broadly, and it's kind of a two-part question. With the run that they've had over the last quarter and the levels that they're at presently, how would you enter resources investment, including precious metals? And then part B of that question is, at the present time, do you differentiate between the values of the juniors, the smaller exploration-oriented mining companies versus the more senior producers? And where do you place the value on them today?
Well, basically, I mean, what has happened is that the resource stocks in general, the Freeport, McMorrins of this world and the Newmonts and so forth, and in particular the exploration companies, they got battered in 2008 and decimated. And they have recovered, that is correct. Newmont is over $45 and so forth, and from the lows they had big moves. And the exploration companies, percentage-wise, had also big moves. But the exploration companies, in my opinion, offer still very good value. They're still very low. And as an investor, I would consider buying some of them. Now, what has to be clearly understood is that exploration companies don't really have a cash flow, and they have to discover something to make it work, and many exploration companies will not survive, and others will be taken over by the majors, and there will be a lot of volatility in the sector. But it's an exciting sector, but investors can't just buy one exploration company and hope to make 100 times their money. The likelihood that they buy the right one is not very high, so they have to buy a basket or a fund of exploration companies to be properly diversified. It's like if you buy nanotechnology companies or biotech companies that are in research and development. They have no cash flow, and they have to find something in order to create value. And out of 100, maybe only 3 will find something. It's the same in resources. So one has to be diversified, and one has to understand the volatility. And one has to go with the exploration companies that have someone in the background with deep pockets.
Frank, do you have some follow-on to that?
Yes. The world is riskier, and it will stay that way. And I think just to complement what Marcus said, and that real diversification amongst the commodities, there's a rotation that takes place by countries and projects and the infrastructure spending needs. So you can have a 9-month run where coal is going to do well, and then you're going to have iron ore, and then there'll be a correction as restocking's been done, the rebuilding's been done, such as we saw a boom for iron ore for cars in North America, and helped many of the metal prices. So I think you have to recognize that what we do is to try to understand what those supply-demand factors are and overweight and underweight where we think a trend is in those commodities. As for juniors and seniors, in a diversified portfolio, we try to have a small portion of the explorers, but the developers that are producers that are coming on stream or expanding that is where we believe we get our alpha, and we feel that there's a high correlation to the financial. There's a sentiment factor. So the financials are doing well, then what happens we've seen going back over 20 years of data points is that the juniors and small cap stocks do exceptionally well. Last year when we had the blowout in the global economy, that you saw that the small cap stocks even got punished more, even if they had positive cash flow and earnings. So it's recognized some of those sentiment factors. Right now the banks are under repair. They can borrow inexpensively, and I think that it shows up with the juniors. And there's lots of M&A work that's taking place, so we feel that there's lots of opportunity. But one has to be very selective in that whole process.
Thank you. Dr. Faber, there's an interesting question about trying to help investors understand, those that have not traveled to China, help them understand what a day in the life of the Chinese is, and specifically, is it possible to compare the lifestyle of the Chinese today to the U.S. in U.S. terms, perhaps from the 50s or early 60s, in terms of the spreading, the increasing democracy, I guess, of capital, the middle class?
Well, I mean, I would say that in China and in the whole of Asia, in the whole emerging world, we still have a lot of poverty, and we have a lot of people who can't afford to live a very free life. In other words, they can't afford to travel, and they can't afford to make many choices in their in their lives, they work as factory workers and earn maybe $300 a month or something like this. And on that, you don't live well. But at the same time, in both India and China, you have the emergence of, say, an urban class that is hard working, and these are people work for companies in clerical positions and also in management positions, and they do relatively well. So if you have 1.3 billion people, all you need is essentially 200 million people that live a reasonable lifestyle, and you have a huge market. And that's why the market for mobile phones in China and for motorcycles and for many, many items and even internet, there are more internet users in China than in the U.S. is all logical. The country is more than four times larger in terms of population, and India is 2.5 times as large in terms of population as the U.S. So over time, starting from a low level, these countries, they move up the scale in terms of standard of living. Their GDP per capita improves, and the middle class expands. Now, is everything perfect? No. And is the stimulus package in China working? Probably not very well. It leads to a lot of speculation and further misallocation of resources, bubbles in properties and so forth and so on. But I take the view, say, if you look at the next 10, 20 years, and I'm not here speaking and picking on the U.S. alone, I don't see how the lifestyles of the average household in Western Europe and in the U.S. will improve meaningfully. I just don't see it. On the other hand, if I look at a country like Vietnam, they have a GDP per capita annually of $800. It can easily go to $3,000 over the next 15, 20 years. And the same for China and the same for India. And you will have suddenly in India a middle class of maybe 200-300 million people that will not buy Mercedes cars, but they'll buy a Nanmo for $2,500. And that will also drive the demand for resources up, and it will essentially also be an incentive for people to work very hard, because once a family moves from the bicycle to the motorcycle, it's an improvement in the standard of living. But then when you move to the car and you drive your children in a car to school, it's a huge increase in your standard of living and also in your social class. And therefore, I think that this will essentially take place. And in the Western world, I think that our children, they'll be at war, and they'll have civil unrest, and their standards of living will not be as good as ours.
Mark, it's Frank here. One of the things I was interested in seeing in these emerging markets is that basically, it's a cash to play. And what I mean by that, versus North America and Europe, it's credit to play. 94% of all cell phones are prepaid each month. There's no credit. Same with cars, same with houses. It's predominantly a cash business. Whereas, so the slowdown in the world has not impacted them as greatly because they've not had this massive amount of leverage where they need credit to play. Would you agree with that when you travel these countries?
Well, I mean, I agree 100%. In Hong Kong, after 97, property prices didn't drop 30%. They dropped 70%. But we had very few bankruptcies. In Hong Kong, 73, 74, the market dropped 90%. There were very few bankruptcies because the system is not leveraged. I can't emphasize sufficiently the deficiency in the intellect of the Fed chairman, the past and the present one, in neglecting the huge build-up in debt. Because if you have assets, let's say you and I own a house, it's fully paid, it doesn't matter the house drops 30% or goes up 30%. That doesn't change our lifestyle. It's the same house. But it changes our lifestyle if we borrowed 100% against it to buy it in the first place. and we lose our jobs. And in Hong Kong and in China and in Indonesia and Vietnam, only 8% of the people have a bank account. There is no mortgage market. There's no mortgage market to speak of in Russia and in Turkey and in most emerging economies. And that's where I see a huge potential for, say, domestic growth as the domestic financial institutions gradually get their act together and grant mortgages to people, and as their payment mentality improves, then obviously with mortgages, more people will be able to afford to buy a house or an apartment, and that will drive some domestic consumption.
Mark,
that's a very important point. The absence of leverage in emerging economies, and I have it on one slide about China there, when I talked about the essentially increase in Chinese market share of steel and aluminum production. Next to it, there's a slide that shows low leverage in the Chinese economy.
Mark, the next question is, why do you think the media is so attacking capitalism in every form, but not the policymakers, the lawmakers, both the UK and the US, that allowed the Glass-Steagall Act to blow apart and get huge leverage by the Fannie Mae's and the banks and allow people to buy houses with no recourse and no money down? Why do you think the media is addressing these lawmakers that allow this disaster to take place?
Well, I think, sadly, there is this intertwining between business interests, the media, and government. And so there is very little critique of government officials coming from the private sector. I know hedge fund managers that manage a lot of money in the United States. They are very brilliant academically. They know what the problems were, but they never, never speak against a Treasury official or make negative comments about Fed policies. Never, ever. And that has to do with the business interests, in my opinion. And that's why I think it's important for Americans to have independent views from time to time from people that do not work for business interests on Wall Street, and for the media that is also very closely linked into the government.
Okay, thank you. Michael, do you have other questions?
Yeah, there's a couple more questions, two more sets of questions. And the first is actually something that both of you could respond to. And it's asking you for a sort of a historical perspective, a longer-term perspective, since you've been at it for a while, on the effect of ETFs on gold prices. So, you know, the impact of the emergence of the ETF as an investment vehicle on gold prices compared to sort of the pattern of gold prices over time. Any comments on that?
Mark?
Well, Frank, you want to start?
I think that for stocks in particular, it's going to affect the formation of capital. If you were to come out with, say, a new stock like Google or Microsoft, you would hardly be able to get that capital unless it's an ETF. Money flows are going more and more into the ETF space, and eventually that will create a great opportunity for value stock pickers. Because they're just, if they're not part of an index or ETF, then they're going to be like orphans, even though their business model is doing exceptionally well. So I think that that's a factor to consider. And as for the bullion, I think it's allowed citizens of the world, wherever they are, to become their own conservative central banks. By owning some gold, it's just prudent, and it's been difficult for a lot of people to have access to gold. Go ahead, Mark.
Yes, I mean, I think one has to look at ETFs in specific terms because they are ETFs and other ETFs. In general, the worst ETFs are the leveraged ETFs that use futures, whether it's for bonds or equities both long and short, because the rollover is very expensive. And the same goes, say, for natural gas ETF. The premium now on natural gas 12 months out is 100%. So unless natural gas really goes up 100% from here, you're not going to make over the next 12 months money in your ETF. Now, I use ETFs occasionally as a trade. I also would say that gold ETFs that buy physical gold, especially the ones where you can get delivery of your gold, like in Switzerland, there are some ETFs where you can actually then get physical delivery. These are desirable investment vehicles, in my opinion. Or an ETF that would buy a basket of stocks, whether it's biotechnology or mining companies and so forth. That these are ETFs that are probably quite desirable for an investor that doesn't manage money and can't efficiently diversify his portfolio. So he buys an ETF and gets the diversification through the ETF.
A question about both natural gas and oil, starting with oil. Offshore in South America, there have been three large discoveries over the last several years, including a recent announcement from BP. Are these discoveries and the possibilities for extraction in the deep water, are they of the size that can do something to impact sort of the balance of supply?
First of all, the big discoveries off Brazil are deep, and have so many technical issues that the infrastructure spending costs are massive. So the process of getting that oil out will take a while. But I think the underlying population growth and needs of countries like Brazil, it'll be absorbed very quickly. And I think that's the important part, is to track the policies of these governments, in particular, like the BRIC countries. Are they putting money back into the infrastructure spending to create a better system for their citizens? Then that will only sustain the economic growth of those countries. So I think that oil will be absorbed quickly. The biggest thing we've seen is not so much oil, but gas. Technology has had breakthroughs in gas. In particular, when you take a look at shale gas, there's lots of shale in the world, and you basically get two units of reserves for shale gas than you do from shallow gas being drilled in Texas or Mississippi, etc. So I think that there are differences. So that getting access to the gas is a lot better because of technology, but there's been no real technology breakthrough for deep oil. And so that's why I think it'll take a while, a substantial time before that oil comes on stream. Mark, do you have any comments?
Yes, I agree. I think we find oil, but as I said, we don't find it in the same quantity. And what investors must realize is that there is no oil reserve that is permanent. All oil reserves eventually are depleted. And so the big fields like Cantarell had already huge declines in production. And also Saudi Arabia will one day have a decline in production. And when that comes, and the time is still a period of increased demand, I think the price will be supported. Now, where technology can make a difference is obviously in alternate sources of energy, like you can use natural gas increasingly, and you can use uranium and coal and so forth and so on. But it's a question of price. I mean, you can't have solar panels that are economical and electric cars that are economical with an oil price at $30 a barrel. It has to be around this level or higher. And my positive stance to the party stems not so much because I expect a global economic boom. I think the boom conditions we had in 2006 were exceptional in financial and economic history. We're not going to go back to that level anytime soon. But I believe that the money printing will be unprecedented because the deficit will need to be financed and the unfunded pension liabilities and Medicare and Medicaid will be so huge starting 2018. But the number of people turning 65 is from now on going to explode in the United States. And that requires much higher health care expenditure. So from that point of view, I think the U.S. has to print money. Otherwise, the whole system collapses. And in this environment, you want to be in assets that can't be multiplied easily.
On a related note, is there expectation, Frank, that perhaps this is the year that natural gas starts to emerge as a green fuel, is regarded as such, and therefore, with the green movement growing as it is vociferously, could that become a more significant fuel source for the U.S. going forward?
It could, Michael, but so far we've seen is that it gets lumped in with oil. And so the energy policies don't bifurcate and separate the benefits of the natural gas versus oil. And until the Beltway recognizes the significance of the difference, there's no real policies out there that would benefit inexpensive, environmentally friendly gas.
Okay. Thank you. And in conclusion, a question that's especially for Dr. Faber. George Soros and Bill Gross in the U.S. have described their outlook as with the expectation that there's a double-dip recovery underway. Is that your expectation? Could you just give us a little bit of your prognostication on how a recovery will take place here in the U.S.? Or globally, excuse me.
Well, my view is that the economy began to weaken in 2007, and the recession probably began in October 2007, but it wasn't visible because economic statistics are badly distorted in the United States and doctored. It's just a case now that in one of the government offices someone has resigned because, as he claims, employment is much lower than what the government is publishing. But anyway, the recession began at the end of 2007, and then the global economy fell off the cliff between September 2008 and March of this year. And then, because of the huge, and this is an unprecedented, coordinated stimulus that was injected into the global economy, not just in the U.S., everywhere, and because of zero interest rates, the global economy stabilized. But in my opinion, there's no recovery. There are some sectors that got hit so hard that the demand was way below the trend line, and these sectors are now somewhat rebounding, but from a very low level. On the other hand, the other sectors that are still going into recession, and if you have an unemployment at this level, and you have an aging population, I don't think that consumption will come back. And we've seen yesterday the figures, the consumer credit contracted at the record pace in July, and has been contracting now, I think, for 5 months in a row. This is unprecedented. So I don't think that is much of a recovery. But we have to differentiate stock market and economic activity. I would argue the weaker the economy is, the more the stock market will go up, because the money that is being printed will not go into the construction of factories and the acquisition of plants and capacity expansion and capital space. It will just go into speculating in something.
Thank you, Frank. Any comments there?
No, I think it's just great, Mark. You're in Thailand right now, correct?
Correct.
So just part of the overall U.S. global experience, Mark is phoning in from late in the evening, And we're reaching out all around the world and trying to get a better grasp of trends and what are the opportunities at the same time with a balanced perspective, what are the risks. Mark, I want to thank you once again for a great presentation and covering many, many issues. And most important, I enjoy you because you stimulate and you provoke a different perspective of thinking, which is so important in the marketplace.
Thank you,
thank
Dr. Faber.
Thank you for having me on your program. And thank you for the listeners to have had the patience to listen to us.
I think they all enjoy it. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's webcast. On behalf of U.S. Global Investors, thank you for your participation. And a special thanks to Dr. Faber. And a reminder, please do visit his blog and homepage, www.markfaberblog.blogspot.com. That's MarkFaberBlog. And his homepage, www.gloomboomdoom.com. If you haven't already, visit usfunds.com, where you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, which is Investor Alert, and can also visit Frank's blog, which is entitled Frank Talk. That's located on our homepage as well. Please let us know if we may be of assistance to you in any way. Dial us at 1-800-US-FUNDS, 1-800-873-8637. Again, thanks for joining us. Take care.